Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to bring you yet another boozy program.
Now, we don't have too many of those. We just have a couple.
Well.
Anybody think we were heavy drinkers?
No, we have three now.
Oh, we have three now. Okay, well, we do. If there isn't a cocktail renaissance going on in your town, you're not paying attention. You're not looking in the right places.
Yeah.
And certainly we have one like that in Pittsburgh with some bars with extraordinary collections of 800 different American whiskeys and all that kind of stuff. And one of the guys who's been behind this whole thing from the start here in the Berg, we caught up with, he's kind of hard to catch up with him, but we caught up with
Sean Enright.
Sean Enright.
He's wonderful.
Where is Sean these days? I mean, he's been all over.
He's a spork.
He's now general
manager at Spork.
Okay, but before that he was a cocktail aficionado and producer.
He helped start the Bartenders Guild chapter in Pittsburgh.
There you go. So we decided he was the right guy to introduce today's program.
With his co-writer, Cody McDevitt, wrote a definitive book on Pittsburgh drinks, and I didn't realize we had such a history and the prohibition and everything. It was very unique to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so. the only thing I knew about from here is the Boilermaker, and we all know how you make a Boilermaker, right? Well, listeners, just in case you don't know, you get the bourbon in a shot glass, you get a beer, and you drop the bourbon in the shot glass in the beer. And then you drink it all together and trying to cut yourself on the pieces of glass that broke off when you dropped it.
I didn't know that happened.
I don't really think it. I think it sort of bounces.
I see. I have never tried that.
But if you're really in a hurry to get to La La Land, Boilermakers are the way to go. In the meantime, if you're interested in something a little more sophisticated, Sean Enright at Spork or wherever else he just happens to be at the time is the right guy to look up. So here's Sean.
Well, we're talking to my dear friend Sean Enright, who, with a buddy of his, Cody McDevitt, has written this book that's getting so much attention called Pittsburgh Drinks, A History of Cocktails, Nightlife, and Bartending Tradition. Sean, are you amazed at how much attention you're getting?
I'm a little bit amazed. However, I knew that this had some pretty good legs on it, this idea to promote the Pittsburgh bartending community and the historical side of Pittsburgh.
I would say
I'm a little bit surprised at the traction that it has, but I always thought that it was a good story to tell.
You got to know Cody because he was working on the history and the early history of this, right?
Yes.
And you just then cooked up the idea of doing a bigger project?
Yeah, we actually met up through social media. I had written like a little snapshot history of the current cocktail renaissance here in Pittsburgh. Because as I did research trying to find older articles, it was really difficult to find any past history. I didn't have the access that Cody eventually ended up having. So I was writing this little thing just to try to capture the whole craft cocktail movement that began in 2008, 2010 in Pittsburgh. And I posted on Twitter, and then Cody would send me links to things that he found that were much older. And as we talked, he mentioned that he was working on a book doing research on the history of Pittsburgh bars and taverns. And I told him I was working on a book on recipes with local bartenders.
Uh-huh.
And we just thought it was a great way to combine forces and put out a more complete book that would have a much broader audience.
Now, Sean, you were not just an observer of this
modern cocktail movement, if you like. You were right in the middle of it, right? I mean, you were there behind the bar inventing new cocktails and actively pouring more than one place at a time, I think.
Yes, and that's what, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of what gave me the access to get as many Pittsburgh bartenders involved and give me their recipes and share their recipes. It's nothing else. It's just the fact that I've been everywhere. I've worked with everybody. I founded the United States Bartenders Guild Pittsburgh chapter, and, you know, that put me in a unique position where there really was very few people in the city who could compile a list of recipes and a bartender stable.
Well, you know
that I did. So
you know that I didn't realize the historical significance of the early years at all. I mean, with the Prohibition and stuff, it sounds like the old Wild West here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it was. Pittsburgh was, I think, always a little wild. It was always sort of in the 20s, kind of frontierish, compared to New York or Chicago or L.A. There was a little, we did have a very wild history right from the beginning. As you read the, Speakeasy basically started in Pittsburgh with Kate Hester, and it had to do with the Pittsburgh city of Pittsburgh was taxing the bars so heavily that a lot of bars decided they just wanted to do illegal, illicit sales. And it was the word Speakeasy is actually, Kate Hester is known for creating the word Speakeasy.
That surprised me.
This is actually before Prohibition, right?
Yes,
long before Prohibition, yeah. There's lots of little history. One of my favorite pieces of history is, as a bartender, that the Boilermaker was actually created here in Pittsburgh as well. Of course, we have steel mills, and the mill workers were working on Boilermakers. And, they get out of the mills, they'd walk across the street to their local bar, probably down the south side somewhere. And it was such awful, dirty work. They just want to get a shot in the beer as quickly as possible into their system. And that's where the Boilermaker was started.
And it truly was, you dropped the glass in the beer, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
All down.
That's funny.
Rather crude.
Why would they do that? I think that's so strange.
It is. But, local bartenders have taken that to a whole new level where they're finding beer and shots that, might work together well. And so you are seeing Boilermakers pop up on bar menus, not only in Pittsburgh, across the country, but, in Pittsburgh, we have a little more of a cultural significance to putting a Boilermaker on our menu.
Now, the interesting thing is I grew up in an area in England, which was known for tile manufacturing, but 25 miles away, in the city of Sheffield, there was a we're talking 60 or 70 years ago, there was a then thriving steel industry, making stainless steel and making cutlery and doing all that kind of thing. But the work in the steel mills there was hot and just like it is here in Pittsburgh. And the local guys used to drink a version of beer called mild, which nobody's ever heard of. You could get mild and bitter, and you could get them mixed together, but 100% mild pour was really the captive of the steel guys, because the steel guys got really thirsty.
Want to drink it down, get cool down.
Yeah, and then get another one and send that down too.
I think that was part of it too. They wanted to go over and just do shots all night, but they were really hot and sweaty and dirty, and they need that ice cold beer to cool them down.
Well, there have been some outstanding characters in the drinking business in Pittsburgh. What about some of the early ones? What's the one that was such a hit in New York? And you have the recipe for these famous drinks in here, too. What was New York?
Might be a Manhattan, wouldn't it?
No. This is a Pittsburgh designed cocktail.
There was a number of, like, basically what Cody did is he would, he'd finish every chapter with a cocktail, and this was an idea we came up together, finish every chapter with a cocktail, and then I would use that cocktail to sort of teach a little bit of techniques at the end of every chapter. So we have a number of them. We have the Fuss Fungal, which was...
That's the one I was trying to think of. That was a sensation in Manhattan.
Yeah, and it was, as Cody was doing his research, he was finding it mentioned all over the country. So the Fuss Fungal was, created in Pittsburgh, but just popular all across the country. And there is now no account of it anymore. Nobody has ever, I was doing my research to try to find what was in this recipe. There isn't a single mention of it anywhere as far as recipe-wise goes. It said, it's basically, brown molasses and whiskey. That was the extent of the recipe. So I tried to come up with something a little bit more
Is there anything local as universal as my favorite New Orleans cocktail? What is it?
Which one? The Sazerac?
Sazerac, yeah.
We don't really have anything. As I said earlier, the Boilermaker, I think, is the one standout for us of a true Pittsburgh cocktail. A lot of stuff, as we went through, we just, Fuss Fungal was really popular, but nobody remembers it anymore. So it didn't really have the staying power as the Sazerac.
Uh-huh.
There was a number, like the Pittsburgh East cocktail.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Pittsburgh really wasn't on the mark as far as the major markets go to promote their cocktail, their drinking culture. While it was very strong here, it just didn't get out of the city much.
Yeah, it was strong, and it is a social history. I'm going to admit something here. Is part of how much fun I had reading this book is I was in the culture of the restaurants or the bars in Shadyside. Like I was this big patron of the Encore, using as ID because I was an underage drinker. My mother's, and nobody ever questioned that this young girl was, according to her ID, was 32 years of age.
Yeah, were you on, I think we were on PCNC's Night Talk, and he compared that whole Walnut Street, Shadyside to the Haight-Ashbury.
Oh, yeah.
Were you one of those Pittsburgh Haight-Ashbury kids?
Well, I mean, I don't know about Haight-Ashbury, but I don't really, but we were part of that. But we were also interested in jazz, and you do a parallel with entertainment and the jazz thing.
Yeah. I mean, jazz was so hugely popular in Pittsburgh. And we wanted to focus not just on, cocktails and bars, but also just the nightlife.
Yeah.
So we talked heavily about jazz. We were fortunate to get a number of Teenie Harris photos.
Oh, yeah.
That really captures the entire jazz era.
I remember in the era pre Martin Luther King's death of going, again, underage into the Crawford Grill in the Hill.
Yeah.
And there was never any problems, Then it all changed, and you couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, the Crawford Grill is huge. Like, as I moved here in 1994, and these are names that, still, as I moved here, were very prominent bars, cafes. I still, to this day, hear about the Syrian Mosque. And people,
uh-huh.
They were young when I came to town. They're not as old as I am now, but...
My father belonged to the Variety Club. Many a day did I have dinner there.
Oh, yeah.
And in several locations, yeah. I didn't realize it was that big on the bar scene, but your book points it out. But no, I didn't see, and I mean, I went to all the Mardi Gras, there were a whole bunch of them in Shadyside. And we had all these jazz people performing there too. And then of course the disco thing came in with the, raspberry rhinoceros. And some of the names of these people are things that I grew up with. And so it's interesting. And I never thought of it as something to be noted in a book. I just thought it was part of, what you did growing up.
But you could write a whole book about Froggy Morris, for heaven's sake.
Oh, yes, I could.
It doesn't have four or five more books that need to be written.
It doesn't have a happy ending either, unfortunately.
No, tell me this. You don't mention these after-hour clubs. You mentioned some, but like the Hollywood Soche. This was a big part of growing up in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. We get asked that all the time. It's like, oh, where's this bar? Where's this bartender? The problem we ran into is we went through a publisher and we had very, I wouldn't say very limited, but we had a limited word count. It was our first book going out there. There is, we've discovered, even just since writing this, before anybody's ever actually read it, we're getting comments on our Facebook page. There is so much history and so much to capture. Nobody will ever do the full complete picture because it is a very
broad. Well, do you
broad.
Think Pittsburgh is exceptional? I mean, I know we're not like the New Orleans, and I know we're not like Manhattan, but aside from those big markets, do you think that Pittsburgh had an extraordinary scene?
Yeah, I mean, I think every city has its own scene and its own history. The reason we did this is not only because we live here and we love Pittsburgh, but it's an untouched landscape. Nobody has ever written about the history of the drinking, history of the cocktails. They very rarely do it in other cities. New York doesn't really have a really good history of drinking book. We kind of wanted to do this and sort of create a template and get other cities to do the same thing. I think New York and Chicago, they have so much history and the nightlife is always involved in their history. But, little small cities like Nashville or Cleveland, I'd love personally for this book to influence somebody there to say, hey, we should do the same thing. We should get all our bartenders together and write a bunch of recipes that are regional and write about the history of the nightlife thing.
Now, I want to jump ahead to this resurgence of the cocktail, which is a reflection of a resurgence of the cocktail across the country. I know that. But what were the immediate events that caused this to happen in Pittsburgh?
The immediate events were, Spencer Warren.
Yes, Spencer. We've interviewed him. We've interviewed him before.
Yeah, he ran Firehouse and Embry.
Uh-huh.
He had probably the largest influence. He was going to other cities. He was going to New York and Chicago, and he was going to these places that we can only now read about, such as Milk and Honey in New York City. He was trying to bring back this idea of the craft cocktail. So he started, he had Firehouse Lounge. The downstairs Embry was just a coat check room, and he decided to turn that into what would eventually become Embry. The missing puzzle piece was Fred Sarkis. When he met Fred Sarkis at a football game, and he bumped into him, and Fred was drinking green chartreuse out of the bottle, I'm not sure the exact what happened there, but he brought Fred back to Pittsburgh. Fred basically created the cocktail lounge, Embry, which was a strictly pre-prohibition cocktail bar, no vodka, no sodas. Everything was either a Fred recipe or a classic cocktail. And Fred really kicked it off. He's the only bartender there. He got a lot of attention from folks like China Millman. He wrote a lot of cocktail stuff. Post Gazette. Anyhow, so basically he was Fred.
Oh, I know who you mean. Yeah. I don't know his name, but I know who you mean.
Yeah. So as Fred was doing his thing at Embry, bartenders across the city caught their attention. We would all go down there. We would have drinks after work. We would watch Fred. We'd see what he was doing. He was using ingredients that we'd never played around with before, savory ingredients. Most of the menu was gin, which, you know, most bars had like one or two gin bottles behind their bar. He was a big proponent of whiskey, was promoting that. And, it really changed the scope of how everybody looked at cocktails in Pittsburgh, at that moment. I was at 11 at the time. I was wine director there with Maggie Mefke.
She's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, we were right there, we were about six blocks away down at 11. We would go up there every night after work, and Fred would do his theatrics, teach us things, and it was always tasting us on stuff and talking about the technique and everything. And that was really the start of the craft cocktail resurgence in Pittsburgh. That was, you know, we were sort of reading articles out of New York and trying to emulate what was going on there, but it really takes somebody to physically show you how it works to get ignited.
How is it, not just in Pittsburgh, but across the country, that female bartenders are really coming out strong?
I would say it is across the country. Female bartenders are a strong force. But I always thought the beauty of Pittsburgh is that they've always been the strong force.
Yes.
You know, the two of our strongest, the ones who started the Bartenders Guild with me were Summer Volker and Maggie Mefke.
Yes.
And it's even blown up, gotten even more powerful. You know, Taco, when it first opened, they called themselves the Taco Bells. It was all female bartending staff, and some of the bartenders are the strongest we have in the city, with Nicole Battle and who else was back there at the time. I know Maggie was back there. When Salt of the Earth opened, the girls were called the Salt Shakers, and it was Maggie and Summer and Erica Joyner. And women have always been influential in this city, this bartending scene. And when the craft cocktail thing started, I know other cities, they do talk a lot about the sexism and the issues with gender in other cities, but we never, I mean, as far as the craft cocktail thing goes, we never really had that. It was the women led the front lines, and they always have, and have always been a powerful force. I know there's always issues with roles and equal pay in throughout any industry, but as far as the craft cocktail thing went and the creativity and the people who were at the forefront, the women were always the forefront, pushing the boundaries.
Well, I can tell you this, that there were lots of characters, and you profile a lot of them in this book. And the other boon for this book is that you have endless recipes for cocktails by these people, and you get to read about the person who created them, as well as get the recipe and recreate them at your own environment. Sean, you've had a wonderful journey so far, and I hope you continue. Again, the book is Pittsburgh Drinks, and I can't tell you, I've had this at the gym reading it, and everybody's noted it, so I hope your sales are good.
Good. Yeah, you know, I hope we sell a whole bunch of them. My greatest joy just comes from putting Pittsburgh in the spotlight and letting the world know how great our bartenders are. And I hope that's the end result of everything else.
I hope so too.
Well, thanks for your look into history and your present day work. It's a delight to see it happening. I sense a sequel of books in wide.
Oh, I think there's going to be many volumes to come.
Wide range of different directions. So we better let you go so you can get back at the typewriter.
Great, Jake. Cheers. Thank you, guys. Very nice talking to you again.
Okay, Sean, after that, I guess the only word we can say is, well, we could say cheers, or we could say the English version, bottoms up. And we'll be back with an up rather than a bottom right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You know, reading this book by Sean and Cody, I mean, it reminds me that Pittsburgh has really made its mark in liquor of late. We have nationally recognized Boyd and Blair vodka. We've got Wiggle whiskey that keeps taking awards. And then we have...
And they just keep on coming.
And they keep... Now we're going to be talking to Tim Russell next, who has a success in the form of Maggie's Farm Rum. And let's hear what he has to say about why it's called that and how they're winning all these awards nationwide.
Okay.
We were just kidding with our next guest, Tim Russell, who is the founder of Maggie's Farm Rum, that it might be a very peculiar interview since we've been sitting here sipping out of the bottle of the Maggie's Farm Rum. Tim, I never heard of Maggie's Farm Rum at one point, and then the next thing I knew, you were winning awards all over the country. What happened?
I don't know. I think we did really well with, I guess, marketing the product on the competition circuit, as opposed to spending it on, you know, print ads and things like that in the media. So it was nice because we actually got to measure our product against others to see how it stood out, and it did well, and that kind of got picked up by the media with a lot of sort of bonus free advertising, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have wonderful citations of awards on your website where, I mean, you blew away the experienced larger producers, right?
Yeah, we've done pretty well. On both the American kind of craft spirit circuit, two big competitions there, but also on the international circuit as well.
So there's like a whole circuit of trade fairs. Like there is in the wine business too.
Yeah, I know there's a ton in the wine business, I'm certain. Beer, I know I have some beer experience. I know there's kind of like one or two big competitions within beer. Wine, I'm sure it's a little bit different. Same thing with spirits. There's just, you know, I might get an email once every couple of weeks asking to join a competition I've never heard of, and you know, whoever knows, who knows where. But there's key ones that stand out. Just kind of participate in the bigger, you know, more reputable ones.
Uh-huh. Why rum? I mean, what did you do before Maggie's?
A couple of things. I mean, originally, I was a project manager for a defense contractor. It was a small company based out of Uniontown, which is about 30, 40 miles south of Pittsburgh. When I started working there, it was actually a really good company. It was a small company. And then it kind of got bought out by a bigger company. Things got a little bit worse. Got bought out by an even bigger company, and then things got really bad. I ended up leaving that job, and sort of... we agreed to leave together, I guess you could say.
Uh-huh.
And that made it possible for me to kind of do what I wanted to do. I originally thought about opening up a brewery because I had been brewing home brewing beer for about 7 or 8 years at that point.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I think the problem with that was I saw some saturation. It seemed like everybody and their brother was opening up breweries, especially in the Pittsburgh area.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second round. They're going through it again. I mean, yeah. I went through the first round, too, with the brew pubs.
And but right around that same time, I saw some legislation in the pipeline that's going to allow a distillery in Pennsylvania to sell direct to the public by the bottle and by the glass. Previously in Pennsylvania, you could have an operational distillery, but they could only sell it wholesale to the state or outside of the state,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. It's what a lot of big manufacturers do, but your margin is really small at that point, so you kind of need a really big operation for it to be sustainable. For that reason, no distilleries had opened in Pennsylvania since Prohibition until 2005.
Now that's
in that time period, only two had opened. So the first one, Philadelphia Distilling, had opened in 2005. And then Boyd and Blair Vodka had opened up in Glenshaw.
Yeah, well, that's another one that took off, my goodness.
Oh, right. I was thinking of Michter's, but of course Michter's, the owner bought the rights, but he actually makes the spirits in Kentucky.
Michter's was in eastern Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Michter's was open, I guess. They reopened. They were an existing distillery before, prior to Prohibition. So when Prohibition ended, Michter's reopened. And they closed in the 70s officially.
Right.
And then someone bought the name after the distillery closed.
Yeah, he bought the formulas too, I think. He's a nice man.
There's no formula. Michter's comes from a factory in Indiana. There's a large wholesale operation called MGPI in Indiana. All they do is mass produce bourbon and rye whiskey.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of companies actually buy from this factory,
uh-huh.
and then they put their own label on it and say it's, you know, Granddaddy's recipe.
Jeez.
It's not. It's the exact same formula that's in a dozen other bourbons.
Well, you never can trust anything. The latest thing is I read about was garlic powder, which is being marketed with a filler of ground chalk. Now talk about
really read your labels. Make sure it says distilled and bottled by.
Uh-huh.
If you ever see a label that says produced by, chances are that company that's on the front of it didn't make it. It's called merchant bottling. It's a really widespread practice, which is fine. My problem with it is that most people aren't transparent about it.
Uh-huh.
When you say that, they don't say.
Yeah, Michter's is one of those brands, actually.
We interviewed somebody who seemed...
I'm sorry?
I mean, we interviewed the guy that ran it, and he seemed to be straightforward. I'm surprised.
They actually distillery had tried to open recently, and they hired the most recent Michter's master distiller.
Uh-huh.
And they opened under a different name called Bombergers, which I think the name Bomberger had some ties. This is how I understand it anyways. Bomberger had some ties to the Michter's brand. And when this company tried to open in eastern Pennsylvania, Michter's sued them into the ground.
Oh, no.
Hey, that's not very nice.
So, I mean, now Michter's has opened up a distillery recently. So they are now producing their own product. It'll be, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years before they actually have their own product.
Now,
bottles, I'm certain.
Now, let's go back to first principles, Tim. Why rum? Why rum? Was it just that nobody else was making it, or...?
Exactly. Nobody else was doing it.
Well, you just associate it with the Caribbean. You never think of making it, right?
Yeah, no, and people thought it was weird, you know, Pittsburgh rum. So it was kind of... It was interesting. It was a double-edged sword, I guess.
Uh-huh.
We were the first commercially available craft rum made in Pennsylvania on the market. And that interested a lot of people. Because, again, it's like rum from Pittsburgh. It's a really odd thing. People associate with the Caribbean. We may have been the first rum. We're definitely probably the first rum made on the market since Prohibition. Possibly the first in Western Pennsylvania ever. There is rum history in the Philadelphia area because it was a port city, so they had access to molasses.
Right. But you don't use
like
molasses.
That.
You use turbinado, right?
Yeah, we use a different sugar base.
Is that better than using the other?
I wouldn't say it's better. It's different.
Different.
So we chose turbinado sugar, I think, for a young white rum, which obviously we had to start off with.
So that was your first one.
I liked it better. Uh-huh. It gave it a little bit different character. Turbinado is almost a whole sugar.
Yeah.
Sort of like a dehydrated cane juice.
Yeah, I mean, pastry chefs love it.
It's not processed nearly as much as the molasses. Molasses is actually a byproduct of sugar processing.
Uh-huh.
The sugar processing industry preceded rum making. So back in the colonial area, cane that was being grown in the Caribbean was sent back to Europe for processing for sugar. And molasses was a byproduct that had no use.
Huh.
But the
molasses was fed to slaves. It was grown on roads to keep dust down. You can only put so much in your pancakes, but it's largely a waste product.
I see. Now, tell me this.
And
yeah, go ahead.
So that's how rum kind of became a molasses.
Okay.
The use for the molasses. Ours is different, though. We use whole sugar. It gives a different character. It costs a little bit more, but again, it makes the product stand out, I think.
Uh-huh. Now, you started in 2005, you said.
No, actually, that was the first distillery that had opened. That was Philadelphia Distillery. Laws had changed around 2011, I think, that allowed direct sales to the public by the bottle and by the glass. It was the first time in Pennsylvania history that you didn't have to, since Prohibition anyways, that you didn't have to go to a liquor store to buy a bottle. You could actually buy it direct from the distillery.
Now, did this relate just to rum, or did it apply to whiskey?
All
like,
spirits.
Like Wiggle Whiskey makes. So.
Oh, yeah, same thing. They were actually the first, I think they were the first distillery or second distillery to open after the law changed.
Okay.
And Wiggles, they're a family of lawyers, too, so they were actually really helpful in the process of getting that legislation changed, along with the two existing distilleries at the time, which were Boyd and Blair and Philadelphia Distillery.
Yeah, you know, I like the people at Wiggle Whiskey. They're really good-hearted people.
Yeah, they've been really good to us and really helpful. So they're just down the street from us. They're kind of our big brothers.
Yeah, I wondered if there was a connection there. I mean, I guess they sort of helped pave the way for you thinking that it might be possible to do this. But let's go back to rum just a little bit, because rum as a spirit generally available, like made in Britain or made in other parts of the world, started out as a product that was given by the tot to the sailors on British warships for several. In fact, they still do that today. But this is what's called Navy rum, and it has one characteristic that stands out, and that it's very dark.
The strength, too. It's usually really high in strength.
And you started out with a rum at the other end of the scale, which is pure white, of which we have a sample, which is the spirit that the modern rum drinker of products like Bacardi has adopted and said, we like this really well.
Yeah. Again, Bacardi is a light neutral rum. It's known as a Cuban or Puerto Rican style rum, which in a way are closer to vodkas. They're lighter in body, a little bit lighter in flavor. It's because they're column distilled. We actually pot distill the rum too. So pot distilling is the opposite end of the spectrum.
But that's what you do, pot.
We pot distill, yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
We have pot stills. We had them made in Spain, and what that does is it actually allows more of the flavor and aroma compounds to come through the distillation rather than removing them.
Well, it's funny.
Spirits have more body, more flavor.
It's funny. Let's explore that a little bit further, because most vodkas have no taste.
Right, and that's the definition of vodka. It's not supposed to taste like anything. It's just kind of supposed to be easy drinking, which is fine. I think it's kind of boring, but, I mean, that's... But, you know, vodka is what it is.
But even white rum has quite a lot of flavor, and some people like it because it's sweet, and other people don't like it because it's sweet.
Sweetness is a weird thing with rum, too. Again, it's made from sugar. Technically, all spirits are made from sugar. It's just the sugar source. Brandy is made from the sugar that comes from grapes. Whiskey is made from the sugar that it comes from starch conversion that exists in the grain. So no spirits are really naturally sweet. Rum kind of got this reputation of being sweet in a time period where there were a lot of bad rums, and sugar was added to cover up the flaws in it.
Oh, yeah.
I see.
Okay. So if you have something that tastes really bad, you can add sugar to it and make it taste better. It might be too sweet for somebody, but it'll taste better. And if you have something that's already made from sugar, people don't make that association. You have this trick that was kind of pulled on them. Well, no. We don't sweeten our rums. If you want to sweeten a rum, that kind of comes with the cocktail phase, I think.
Uh-huh.
So you put your Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whatever where else you like in it, huh?
Right. I mean, you're making a cocktail, say a daiquiri, for example. You're going to add your lime juice and your sugar to your white rum, and then you sweeten however you like at that point.
Yeah, I had an aunt who, her drink was
Cuba Libre,
only with that some kind of rum that was 120 proof. And so we used to,
yeah,
to keep a bottle of that in the liquor cabinet for when she visited, and I always advised Peter not to let it anywhere near the gas stove.
Yeah.
That's called Ronrico. I don't know. I don't know whether they still make it. I'm sure they probably still make it.
I don't know.
I've heard that name, but it doesn't mean it's not out there, though.
I think it was 150 proof.
150?
Yeah, it was beyond barrel strength. But now,
yeah, Bacardi used to make a 150.
Do they?
They actually stopped making it, I think. I think there was, the rumor I heard was that there was lawsuits against them because people were catching themselves on fire.
Yeah.
They decided to stop producing the 151.
I would have thought they might be finishing up in the gutter, too.
Yeah. Well, why Maggie's Farm? Where does the name come from?
It's a Bob Dylan song.
Oh, I'll be darned. I never thought of that.
Yeah. So I talked about my old job as a project manager. And if you listen to the song, you'll kind of get an idea of why I chose that name for the company.
Okay.
You don't want to explain it?
It's Bob Dylan actually wrote some feedback there.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan actually wrote the song about his kind of hatred for the music industry. And that's kind of how I felt in the job that I was working.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But somebody that bought out came very inefficient and made it more difficult for me to do my job. And one day I was at my office, and I could have been working the whole day getting things accomplished. Instead, I just sit in a meeting for 3 hours and waste time, and I was really frustrated about that. And I came back to my desk, was really upset, and actually that song came on the radio when I sat down at the job and started the company. I had wanted to do for a long time, and never really had, go for it.
Well, we've got 5 different varieties sitting here, which we've
and
been...
And there are more. I tried to print it off your website, and I couldn't print it.
We've been working our way through. There's one that has coffee in it, which...
And, oh, that's wonderful, isn't it?
And said it tastes a lot like Kahlua, which is a liquor, I guess, that's made directly from cocoa beans.
Well, now, on the website, I learned that they actually use their rum... and they actually cold brew the beans for this coffee, and uh-huh. You can tell there's a brightness to it, right?
Right. A lot of liqueurs, we have 2 liqueurs we've put out. Those just came out actually this month. We've only been making rum for 3 years. We only make rum. We've got probably about 4 or 5 core rums, a couple of one-off specialty batches we do, and then we started the liqueurs. And the liqueurs are all rum-based as well.
Yeah, this Falernum. Falernum?
Falernum, correct.
You know, when do you drink that? It's very peculiar, I think.
Falernum is, historically, it's more of a tiki cocktail mixer. It originated in the Barbados way back when.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of clove in it.
It's a ginger, clove, and lime flavored liqueur.
Okay. There's a lot of clove.
It originated in the Barbados. It's kind of died off. A lot of people haven't heard of it. There's only a few brands on the market, and they're not very good. So it kind of died off of the mainstream. The brands on the market use flavor extracts, and it takes away from the flavor of it, really. Again, we use fresh ingredients in it. So we use fresh whole ginger, whole cloves, lime zest. Every bottle has the zest of about 5 or 6 limes.
This is really labor-intensive stuff, Jim.
It's quite labor-intensive, yeah. But again, that made the best product.
Uh-huh.
We tried using, we bought wholesale dried lime zest, and it just wasn't good.
Uh-huh.
And we decided not to use it, so we have, lime zesting parties at the distillery.
Oh, I'll be darned. They have,
We invite a bunch of regulars down.
Weagle has labeling parties, I know. That seemed like a nice, you know, single scene.
So we give them out some, we give out some free cocktails, and then everyone gets a microplane, and goes through, you know, you go through a few cases of limes to do it. But it made the best product, so we decided that's what we wanted to do. The coffee was the same example. Kahlua, for, Kahlua. It's made with flavoring extracts.
I'm sure.
We don't use flavor extracts. We actually use whole coffee. So the local roaster, Commonplace, roast the coffee for us. We bought a commercial grinder, so we grind it in-house so it's fresh. And then make a cold brew coffee out of it. And that we blend that with the rum, some brown sugar, and some vanilla extract and make ourselves.
Now,
and that makes our coffee liqueur.
Now, what
both of those liqueurs actually just won best in category at the American Distilling Institute Awards just this few weeks ago.
Now, you make a distinction in some of your literature about the way that the rum matures. And I can't remember the details of
it's
that.
It's not oak. It's not. It's
okay. Well, go ahead and explain.
Explain how you age.
We age things, I guess, there's a couple ways to do it. I mean, all the big distillers properly age things. I mean, they've got these giant rickhouses with 50-gallon barrels, and, you know, the rum or whiskey or whatever, and it might sit for anywhere from 2 to, you know, 20 years up or upwards. Caribbean distillers usually age rum in used bourbon barrels, but they continually reuse them. So the rum tastes like rum. Whiskey tastes like whiskey because the whiskey distillers, from the sport, especially bourbon distillers, because it is a law, they have to use a brand new barrel every time.
Right, yeah. That's
so you get a lot of that oak flavor infused into it.
Big dispute among the distillers, I know.
So we actually, when we age our rums, we only get used rum barrels. And if we do get used whiskey barrels, we actually boil water in them to remove the whiskey flavor, whiskey component, any residue in there, but also some of the oaky tannins. It strips them out, and it kind of makes it more of a neutral rum barrel, a neutral barrel. So it's more of a storage vessel as opposed to a source of, you know, oak flavor. And then we kind of rely on the chemistry over time to produce the, you know, traditional rum flavors. A lot of American craft distillers, by contrast, are doing more short aging where they're using smaller barrels. Smaller barrels will give you a higher surface contact area so you can get more of that oak extraction. One thing you're losing in that aspect is the concept of time. You're losing that chemistry that only comes with time.
Right. Well,
so we like to rely on that with sort of an acidified.
You sure know a lot about rum. Now, you got up to speed very fast on this product.
Yeah, I tend to jump around a lot. But
there must have been a book in the library about it, I think.
I could go on for hours about it.
Hey, Tim, there's only
one. We don't have that much time.
There's only one last thing we need to do before we sign off. And that's just let people know where they can get some of this elixir of life.
Yeah. And
So if you're in Pennsylvania, our white and our spiced rum are in the Western Pennsylvania Premium Collection liquor stores,
and also the Philadelphia area
premium stores. Again, if you're in Pennsylvania, you can buy everything off of our website direct. We can mail it to you.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, if you go to our website and if you're out of state, you will be directed through another link to a retailer in D.C. You can kind of buy our core products from there. And we're also working on distribution for a couple of new markets. We just added the Tennessee market a couple of months ago, and we're working with Maryland, New York right now as well.
Okay.
Kentucky, and too, actually.
And your website is Maggie's Farm Rum. Go ahead.
MaggiesFarmRum.com.
Right. And your location in the Strip is? In the Strip, Pittsburgh's historic
Ron's
Strip
Mom
district.
Street. Yeah, we're on Smallman Street in the Strip District on the 3200 block. Not quite near the market area, but not quite in Lawrenceville, right in the middle, kind of in the gritty industrial, you know, urban part of the Strip District.
And you have visits that you can sign on for visits?
We're going to start doing, like, regular tours, I'm hoping in May. And we also have a cocktail bar built in the distillery. So if you come in, we're open Wednesday through Sunday. if you come in Thursday night, Friday night, or anytime on Saturday, we actually have a cocktail bar. So we make all of our cocktails, craft cocktails. We make all of our own mixers and syrups in-house, all fresh squeezed juices. Pittsburgh Magazine actually picked us one of Pittsburgh's best cocktail bars in their January Best Bars this year.
Right. I did see that. Ago. Yep, I saw it. So so you're a success, huh?
I'm still working. I'm not resting or anything yet, so...
You're not retired and sitting on a fortune in rum in barrels ready for the demand to increase.
Not yet.
Great. Well, Tim, it was a pleasure to have you talk to us about your innovative approach to making a living. And I'm sure we're going to hear more about you, and I'm sure you're going to come back on the program. In the meantime, we wish you all the best.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When we started interviewing our next guest about his really rather startling, amazing tequila, we didn't realize that, in fact, the product has a Pittsburgh connection, because no less than famous quarterback at the University of Pittsburgh and with the Miami Dolphins later, and a hometown hero in Pittsburgh, from Pittsburgh, wherever he goes, Dan Marino is one of the investors in this project, as you'll find out as we talk about a beverage which is
rock and roll tequila, and we're going to be talking to Scott Woolley.
You know, it's very special tequila, and interestingly enough, since we started out with Sean and cocktails, tequila is a spirit that's being used a great deal in cocktails, although you can just sip it out of the glass like Ann and Peter do. But here's tequila from Rock and Roll Tequila.
Scott Woolley, I was smitten first by the adorable bottles that you package your tequila in, and then by the purity and smoothness of your tequila. Tell us a little bit about how you got started in this. It's called Rock and Roll Tequila, and the bottles are adorable little guitars, different types of guitars. And there's something also special about the bottles. But what is your background in tequila to start with?
One of my partners and myself have been involved in the tequila industry for many years, more from a marketing standpoint, providing services for Patron Tequila. The gentleman, John Paul DeJoria, who owns Patron, is a very dear friend of ours. So being involved with them from a marketing standpoint kind of got us extremely interested, and we met an individual who I'll say is an old rock and roll promoter who had a very interesting brand. We all teamed up, and here we are today with Rock and Roll Tequila, with uniquely shaped bottles and phenomenal juice inside the bottle. And I myself have a sort of a rock and roll music background, from right out of college up until present day today, from a standpoint of promoting various different rock artists and producing DVDs and live concerts for television for a fair number of music artists.
Now, you have an interesting acquaintance for all those people who are listening to us in our native city of Pittsburgh. You have a good friend who comes from here, who's just a little bit famous.
Yes, one of our partners who I brought on, who's been a very dear friend for many, many years, is Dan Marino. You know, in launching any business, and especially in the spirits business, it's not an easy task. There's very little shelf space. There's a product coming out every day. And I realized that in order to kind of break through the clutter of how many products that are out there and to try to get some of that shelf space, we needed a little bit of ammunition, and I reached out to Dan. He loved the product as we were developing it. And he himself is kind of a rock and roll, you know, roots in his music background, what he loves, and got involved with us.
Tell us about the process. I mean, where does this tequila come from? Where is it made? And you have very special filtration, don't you?
Sure. All of our tequila comes from Mexico, and it's all of our guavi plants that we use are from the Highland Hills of Jalisco, which is where the finest blue aguave plants are. Our product is made in Mexico, and we do have three very unique, I'll say, different SKUs. We have our silver, which we actually call platinum. And the reason we call it platinum is that the other brands that are out there in the market that sell a platinum tequila, which means triple distilled, most of those brands are all selling in the $175 to $200 because it's such an ultra, ultra smooth tequila. We are utilizing that same process, the triple distilled, and bottling it and selling it at a $40 price. Retail number, so it's a huge differential compared to the others that are out there. We have a añejo. We do something very special with it because we recognize and realize that the vast majority of consumers today are health conscious and looking at what they're eating and what they're digesting and what they're putting in their mouth. And we realized in the process, most tequilas, with an añejo or reposado, add a coloring to it, and because they add a coloring, most add a preservative to it. What we do is we filter out everything, and we have a crystal clear añejo. There's one other brand out there that does something similar, but we're extremely proud. The taste is amazing, and it's actually healthier for you than drinking a darker spirit. Our third SKU that we have is, I have to say, one of the most amazing spirits and tequilas that are out there, and it's our mango. And we actually have that in what we call the classic Gibson guitar bottle. We originally, when we were developing that, the thought and the theory and the direction we were going was towards the female market, because there's a lot of women that just don't drink tequila. But I will tell you that anyone who tries our mango is just absolutely shocked by the amazing taste and how wonderful it tastes.
Now, it's interesting that in the case of vodka, which is in a way a similar spirit to tequila, there's almost no flavor left after it's been distilled. We were talking to somebody the other day who makes rum, and somehow even though they distill in a sense in the same way as the vodka and the tequila people do, nevertheless, there's a sweetness associated with the raw material that's in rum that comes through as well. Now, how does that happen with tequila? There is certainly a flavor there, subtle though it might be. How come that's not lost in distillation?
I don't have the full answer of why it's not lost, but I'll tell you that with the distillery process that we go through with our silver, in the triple distilling process, it's so smooth that our tequila, you don't get any kind of burn on the back of your throat. You know, a lot of tequilas that are out there, you get a burn on the tip of your, on the tongue, and then one on the back of your throat. And then there's finer, nicer tequilas where you kind of get a little bit of a burn on the back of your throat. Ours, it doesn't, and our añejo, It's almost kind of a mixed opinion that we get from people, but when you taste it, you try it, it really comes down to the individuals and the person's palate, but you almost get a hint of like a vanilla. Some people feel it's more of a chocolate. It's almost like the way in which everyone looks at something slightly different. It's almost the way in which they taste it. It's slightly different. But the one key thing is that there's no burn on the back of the throat. It's so smooth.
Now, I had another question, and I think I've asked a tequila producer before, but I'm not sure, and I can't remember the answer anyway. Is the agave you pick, is it wild or is it cultivated?
It's cultivated.
Okay. So there are like major plantations that specialize in blue agave?
Correct.
What do you do with the worms?
Worm, no worm, no worms associated. You know, the worm was, of course, this was a fun novelty thing because back in the day, you know, tequila was such a horrible taste that you forgot about the taste because you didn't want to drink the worm. You know, an interesting thing about our product, as I mentioned, that our mango is in what I said, a classic Gibson guitar bottle. All of our products are in the bottles are in the shapes of a guitar, which a beautiful, beautiful bottle.
They're wonderful. Finding,
yeah, and what we're finding is that most people who get their hands on them don't want to throw the bottle away. And, you know, I was just this afternoon having lunch, and I was at a restaurant where they had a bottle, and we were talking to the people at the bar about the bottle, and the bottle was almost empty, and there were three people at the bar saying to the bartender how they wanted the bottle. And and one of the individuals said, I'll pay $20 for that empty bottle.
Oh.
You know, it's just a beautiful bottle. And what's really also unusual about our product is that the top of our bottle, which you would consider to be sort of the neck of the guitar, is actually a bottle upside down on top of our bottle. So all of our main bottles are 750 milliliters, and then on top of it, we have an additional 50 milliliter bottle, and we actually kind of jokingly call that the roadie, something that you can take with you.
No need to joke about that at all. I'm sure that's exactly what people would call it.
We're extremely proud of the juice that's in our bottle. You know, we have a phenomenal shape of our bottles. They're beautifully made, very unique and unusual with the bottle on top of the bottle. But we also, what's inside the bottle is just phenomenal.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I mean, it's really the smoothest tequila I've ever tasted.
Now you've got something else going on that sort of has a music connotation as well, as I recall. You're doing something with Hard Rock?
Well, Hard Rock is one of the first big chains that we're going into. Dan and I met with the CEO and chairman of the Hard Rock. He fell in love with the bottles. And we launched into there, which we're very excited about, you know, because it kind of goes hand in hand, being rock and roll tequila at the Hard Rock, which is great. I'll tell you that we've got different local bands in different marketplaces that have fell in love with our product, that are supporting us, you know, and talking about it while they're on stage. Because it's very unique.
That's amazing.
It's very different. And the one thing that's the most important is that the product itself is exquisite. It's anyone who is I call it a tequila aficionado, when they taste ours, and I ask anyone who's a tequila aficionado, try ours, blindfold yourself, and put another brand next to it and try it. And I'm very confident that Rock and Roll will be the one that they'll take the blindfold off saying, wow, this was the best.
Yes, I agree. And before we leave the topic of your bottles, you have some interesting charitable applications for them, don't you?
Yes. One of the things that we're all, the partners in Rock and Roll, are very committed to is giving back. You know, I have a very dear friend that has a motto that that I believe so strongly in, is success unshared is failure.
Very
and
good.
For
very
us,
nice.
And for us, it's the same thing with Rock and Roll, is that we're taking and utilizing the empty bottles that we get and we collect back some of the bars, restaurants, nightclubs and liquor, you know, that get them. We're utilizing them because we've made a sticker that goes over the bottle and covers up the tequila and all the spirit side to it. And we provide the bottles to, we're doing this with two different organizations for children, and one of the organizations is for children who have different handicaps but are musically oriented, and they're using them as trophies.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
you know, so it becomes a beautiful trophy. You know, when we put the sticker over it, you know, it's an award to who that individual is. We take away anything to do with tequila, but it's a nice kind of recycling of the bottles.
So I guess
and it's also it's also helping promote, you know, music. You know, one of the things for me, you know, I have three little girls that I have one that plays the drums, one plays the guitar, and one plays the piano.
Oh, wow.
You know, and music has kind of disappeared from schools. And for us, it's like we want to be also very much involved in helping promote the art of music and the teaching of music. We're also passionate. We're involved in a foundation called Rhino 911, and it has to do with helping save the rhinos in Africa, which is a, you know, endangered species that's on this planet.
Yeah, we have a cousin who works for that organization.
Yeah, she works for Save the Rhino.
Oh, great!
And she did the New York Marathon in the heat of summer one year, okay, wearing a complete rhino costume.
Yeah, her name is Jo, short for Josephine Shaw, Shaw. And she's based in South Africa.
Yes.
And this is what she does all the time. But we need to do one more thing before we sign off here, which is to let people know where you are presently in distribution and where you plan to be.
We're very focused in our distribution. Our efforts right now are in California and Florida, and our goals are to build it in those two states and build a great brand name, and then from there grow into other states. We do have a little bit of distribution in the Houston and Corpus Christi area in Texas, and in Las Vegas there's a number of different places that have our product. But our real main focus is Florida and California. But anyone who's interested in, you know, getting a bottle of rock and roll or learning more or seeing more about it, you know, rockandrolltequila.com is a place to go. There's a link there that takes you where you could purchase it, and it will be shipped from one of two different places in the country. That's kind of where we are at this moment.
Great. Well, I'm sure it's only going to get bigger and better. And Dan Marino does an enormous amount of good here in his home city of Pittsburgh. It's nice to know that he has a little energy to spare to work with somebody in Florida too. And we're sure you'll continue to be very successful, and we wish you well, of course.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Okay, listeners, so we hope now you're feeling even better informed as to what to do at the cocktail hour.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Are you still here?
I'm still here.
And still here, just in time to say it's time for us to say goodbye. Until the next time, same time, same place. So what do we say?
Bye-bye.